Circuits, 21-40574 U.S. versus Sepulveda.
Good afternoon. My name is Carlos A. Garcia, and I represent Matthew Lee Sepulveda in his appeal of his
Sepulveda?
Yes, sir. His conviction and sentence out of the Southern District of Texas, McAllen Division. With the court's permission, I'll orally argue points of error 3 and 4 and rely on our brief for the remaining points of error.
You may proceed. I'm not remembering by number, so I may have some questions on the other ones, but I always do.
Your Honor, Mr. Sepulveda alleges that the government's lack of diligence in producing, we believe, Brady evidence as it relates to a key witness against him as to count 2 in the indictment,
right.
AA. The government, as the court is well aware, AA had been arrested for a sexual assault. Defense counsel did not become aware of that until after the verdict. Then after the verdict, moved for filed a motion for a new trial under Rule 33, requesting or lack of a confrontation issue as it relates to a Sixth Amendment right.
And then that motion was withdrawn. As far as I can tell, it wasn't reasserted until orally at sentencing. Is that correct?
It was. And the court.
It was, meaning it was withdrawn, and then it wasn't re-urged until sentencing?
Correct. That is correct. There were no new facts in between the time that it was
right.
Respectfully, I substituted in. I asked the court for time.
Yeah. I saw all that. But am I correct? When you do object at sentencing, it is to make what I think of as a Giglio objection. It wasn't to say I need discovery, and it wasn't to say I need a hearing on this. You said the existing record, am I correct?
The existing
record supports reversing the conviction here because what wasn't disclosed undermines the confidence of the outcome. That's your argument
that's
to
our
us
argument.
Today.
Yes, yeah. Your Honor. It is.
Okay.
And that's our argument because of the fact that defense counsel was never allowed the opportunity to properly cross-examine the witness as to his motive or bias in relation to. We understand that it's likely not admissible under 609 and that because it wasn't a final conviction. But the fact that he had a pending state case for a sexual assault, we do believe was relevant to at least the witness's state of mind while he was being questioned or while he was testifying.
Keep going. I mean, it's a difficult, unfortunate issue. You don't deny the government was the one who acknowledged this. They brought it to everyone's attention.
Yes, Your Honor.
At least at the time that they did. And you didn't ask the judge, we need more we need to have a hearing on this. We need to find out when exactly the government knew about his prior arrest record.
Well, I think the government cited that in the record, the government does acknowledge that. May I have a drink?
Yeah, of course.
The government does acknowledge that they became aware of it from the AA's mother after the verdict.
Okay, I mean, I don't mean to talk too much, but I'm curious because so they would have given you extensive Jenks material under Rule 26. All about their lead victim witness. And they would have given you FBI 302, and none of that indicated he'd been already arrested for months?
None. None of it indicated that he had been under arrest for months.
Okay, so you may have made out a case, I mean, we'll hear from the government, that the Giglio material was not turned over, and they had knowledge of it, because attributed to them from the victim witness coordinator, but you still have to get to Kyle's materiality that a failed impeachment question, and there were two equal independent victims against your client.
Well, there were two equal independent victims, but AA was the victim in count 2, which is the count where he was sentenced to 30 years.
I see.
Okay. So he is the only victim or the only witness who testified about what occurred at the police station when he and Mr. Sepulveda were alone, where there were no cameras. You know, looking at other corroborating information or other corroborating evidence for that particular witness, when we look at the elements under Jimenez cites to Van Andersol as it relates, Van Arsdal, as it relates to the factors when looking at a violation or a confrontation violation as to whether there's other corroborating information as to the testimony of AA, and there is no other corroborating information as to the arguably we'd say there was no other cooperating information as to what he testified about what occurred when he was alone with Mr. Sepulveda in the office. There is corroborating information about his testimony when he was taken out of the jail cell, when he's taken it through the hallway.
Can you talk up a little bit?
Yes, sir. When he's taken through the hallway, when he is, but when he's in the office alone with Matthew Sepulveda, there is no corroborating information other than his testimony.
But so, sorry, go ahead. You go. I asked
him. Well, I mean, there's the other offense which occurred a couple of days before, correct?
Correct.
Same kind of conduct, basically alleged.
Yes.
There's the brother's situation. I can't remember, did he testify at trial, the brother, maybe younger brother?
Yeah. I don't remember.
But he was in the cell, the one that was left in the cell, and then when AA came back, I guess, he said, warned his brother to not go and not do, or, I mean.
Stall, correct.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I don't know, you'd said that the evidence that wasn't produced, the Giglio evidence, was relevant. Talk a little bit more about how it was relevant.
Well, it's relevant as to the AA's state of mind as to why it is he would be testifying, whether he's going to slant his testimony in one way or another, knowing
right,
that...
So how so?
If I know I'm under... If I've been arrested and booked, fingerprinted, photographed by law enforcement, and it also goes to contradict his testimony... When he's asked by the United States attorney about his experience with law enforcement, he denies any experience with law enforcement. In fact, he's kind of careful about the way he does it.
Is there something, somehow in my mind, there's an issue about whether the question he was actually asked was mistranscribed, or versus four? Am I making that up? Or, in other words, could the question he was asked about his prior experience, have you ever been arrested or anything like that, is it ambiguous? In other words, could he have been answering as to past conduct at the time this incident that's at issue here, or was he asked more generally? I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact question.
And I believe I do have it. I think I quoted the question, or I quoted his answer.
Yeah, have you ever been arrested or anything like that in the past? Hat yeah. tip to my colleague, Judge Higginson, for
yes,
pulling
sir.
It out of his notebook. And he says, in the past, no.
Yes, in the past.
So I get your... I'll give you the argument you want to cross him and say, oh, you're not being accurate because you have been arrested. And we don't know what that exploration would have yielded. But as far as state of mind, more broadly than that, is there more?
Well, more importantly, Your Honor, from our perspective, a witness's motive for testifying, a bias that he may have, if he testifies in a certain way, if he gives answers to the prosecutor the way the prosecutor seeks them. In his mind, whether there was a deal or not is immaterial. The question about, well, we didn't even know about it and there was no deal, I don't believe it's even material. I think it's important to focus on the idea of what the witness's state of mind was.
Do we know anything about his state of mind?
I'm sorry?
Do we know anything about his state of mind?
Well, that's the problem, that we're not able to drill down in his state of mind when he's being questioned because we don't even know about his arrest. Isn't it true that you're afraid that you might get prosecuted for something or you might get prosecuted more severely because of, depending on how you testify here today? I mean, just a simple question like that. I mean, we go through, if we look at the
You'd
record.
You have to take his answer because you wouldn't be able to offer the arrest.
Correct. Understanding, but I mean, it just... You know, on direct, we go from page, record on appeal, page 457 to 502. Defense counsel's cross was 502 to 505. It's like 2.5 pages. And in effect, what defense counsel did is he just asked, were you out at night with some girls? Was there marijuana? Really doesn't drill down on anything as it relates to.
Well, certainly an undisclosed favor to not prosecute somebody is significant. And your point is, even if it's just in his mind. But I'm just going to ask you, what's your best case applying Kyle's, right, or our case law applying it, that would actually reverse a conviction because of a missed impeachment question opportunity?
Your Honor, it's our position that the court should grant a new trial.
I know.
And allow...
But it's not something, I mean, I'm not justifying it, and the government's got its opportunity to answer. It's not exculpatory evidence. It's you were unable to ask a question that you may have had a good faith basis to ask. You wouldn't have been able to offer extrinsic evidence, probably. So what's the case where that is undermines the confidence of the outcome?
Well, I believe there is a case in the line of cases.
Yeah, okay, it's there.
There is a line in the line of cases, but not included in our brief, and so I won't mention it. But it is cited, actually.
Okay. This is Confrontation Clause rule.
Yeah.
Okay, well, all right. But fine. You're saying it's in the brief. You've got case law that supports that. Just because your time's ticking away, when you say you were going to reach one other issue, is it the commenting on the silence, or what was your other issue?
No, Your Honor, just the fact
that... Is this the only one you really...
This is the only one that the court didn't grant a new trial as it relates. Points 3 and 4 did not relate. We can touch on the right to remain silent if we can for the last 4 minutes.
Well, I guess that is a difficult issue, I think, for district judges generally. Your client invoked his right to not allocute.
Correct.
No comment.
Yes, sir.
And then the district judge says, boy, I wish I'd seen some remorse.
Yes, Your Honor. And
so you're applying Mitchell to that.
We are, because at the last paragraph of Mitchell states that they don't, you know, the Supreme Court did not hold that it didn't apply or that this right to remain silent applies when the court is considering a lack of remorse. And so we're asking the court to find that in this case, I mean, the judge says it on the record that because he remained silent, he did not, he didn't hear any kind of allocution from him. There was nothing. And he just said, you know, no comment. And the judge said, you know, something for the victims. And he held it against
him. Are you saying that the court did draw an adverse inference from the silence?
I am. Considering the objections that were made at sentencing, I am. I understand that he was subjected to a life sentence and he sentenced him to 360 months. But we think, given the facts of this case, in comparison to other cases, a sentence of 360 months for a young man that has no criminal history was unreasonable.
It is.
But he was silent, right?
Yes, sir. He was.
And what is the evidence that you would point to that the court drew an adverse inference from his silence?
When the court states that he showed no remorse for his actions he said, at Record on Appeal 645 to 646, I'm disappointed that you didn't take the opportunity to at least apologize or show any empathy towards what happened to these young men. I mean, you saw them testify. These individuals were very candid and truthful testifying. I'm disappointed to me that you didn't at least show some empathy towards them. I understand that you need to preserve your Fifth Amendment rights because of appeal, but that wouldn't have prevented you from offering empathy as any of us who listen to them and watch them. So that's the portion of the record that I would look at, 645 to 646.
We don't have any controlling law in this area, do we? It's a thin line, because defendants can't allocute, and if they don't show remorse and victims can speak, a district judge can enhance.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what would be the rule of law you would announce? That Mitchell applies so the judge can't even talk about remorse?
Given the facts of this case, I don't know about other cases,
okay. But
given the facts of this case, the fact that our client did not testify at his trial, that he intended to appeal, that Fifth Amendment privilege continued to protect and to shield him from some sort of adverse punishment as a result of his silence.
Now, what if I say sequentially the district court had already chosen the prison amount before that little colloquy occurs?
Then I don't think I'd have an argument.
But that is what happened, right? Don't concede that quickly.
I mean,
sequentially, he says, this is what you're going to get. It's a downward departure. Then at the very end, there's this, where's the remorse for these kids? So it seems a little disconnected and after the fact.
Well, I think the court didn't need to offer that.
I agree.
And I think he offered it. If he doesn't offer it, we're not here before Your Honor arguing what we're arguing. We wouldn't have known. And so many times we're left with what a district judge is thinking, and all we have to go by is what's on the record. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. You have rebuttal time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Akins?
You're free to start where you want to, but since we were just talking about this adverse inference, if it was, would the outcome, what would the outcome be under our precedence?
So that's a wonderful question. I think when you're talking about the lack of remorse, the best case that shows the government's position is the Navarro case. So there's several Fifth Circuit cases that have come since Mitchell that have shown these kinds of statements can be used as a factor. And I think what's interesting that Judge Higginson hit off the bat was the sequential order of things. If you go back and look at the record, as the judge is going through all the 3553A factors, he talks about the egregious acts that happened to these victims. He's well aware of that. But then he also talks about the defendant's age. This defendant is 25 years old. And so he's in that.
A little bit.
I'm sorry. He's in that spot where he's looking at both sides. He's looking at this defendant under the factors. He's looking at the community and these children. And so what's important, I think, is he was given a downward variance, but also the statement was made later. It was not given in the colloquy about the 3550.
These arguments are sort of are plain error arguments, and it is being reviewed only for plain error. Is that correct?
On the substantive reasonableness, on the lack of remorse?
Well, had an objection been made, a district court would be able to say, now I'm not punishing you for this.
You're right.
But we're sort of guessing.
We are, but I will say there are two.
So I guess, but then if you agree and they agree, everyone agrees that we're reviewing for plain error, the first question is, was there error? And is the government able to point to case law? I don't know about Navarro, but I assume the defendant actually allocuted and therefore showed no remorse in the allocution. What's your best case where a defendant does stand on their right to not speak, and yet the court says, I don't hear any remorse? Here's the punishment.
So most of the cases do have to do with the defendant pleading guilty, and so it's a little bit different. The Simpson case from this court has to do with the trial, where then the defendant doesn't want to speak. The Navarro case is a little bit more victim-oriented, where he just minimizes his facts.
As soon
as
the defendant
different.
Speaks at trial or allocates at sentencing, I think it's fair game because they aren't standing on their right. But if you should tell me if you agree or disagree. Mitchell does apply to sentencing.
Yes.
Okay. And do you think a district judge can say, oh, if you're not going to comment, that gives me no sense of remorse. I'm going to punish you more. Is there some line you're urging between silence and remorse? Right? You can't comment on silence. You can't punish for silence, but you can for lack of remorse. Yeah. Is that the...
This is reminding me of Scalia's dissent in that Mitchell case, where he says we're grappling with this fine line on your Fifth Amendment rights versus remorse, and that lack of remorse can be commented on, it can be a factor, but in this case, it's a minor factor. It isn't even listed in the statement of reasons under the 3553A factor. And I think the biggest difference in this case than the cases we've given you is this defendant got a downward variance. Mm-hmm. So hanging your hat on the argument that this one side comment that was made later during sentencing that maybe shouldn't have been said but was, this is a very emotional case. You can see how these things have been said. Okay. But when you are...
I'm interpreting that to be there isn't a clear rule of law the government's urging or other circuits have taken. But in this case, since it's subject to plain error review, it didn't cause a miscarriage.
If you look at the totality of the circumstances, yes, Your Honor, I believe that's true. He just said it as an afterthought. It wasn't included in the reasons. And he wasn't given a harsher sentence. So to say that it affected a sentence that he had already been given isn't really logical in our mind.
You've got 15 minutes, and I may want to, and colleagues may want to take a lot of that time with this Giglio problem.
I understand.
Am I correct in this timeline? a lead government victim witness is arrested months before the trial. Then he testifies for the government. After he testifies, the federal prosecutor calls an assistant district attorney. And after that call, the grand jury no-bills. Is that a correct timeline?
Your Honor, that is correct. I will note that when this is part of the sentencing hearing, when the federal prosecutor called the state prosecutor in charge of that state case, she was told it was in a set of cases that was scheduled to go to grand jury. So there's nothing to indicate our interference pushed the case along, but that is what we were told it was about to be presented. And then a week or two later, we were told that it had been no-billed.
Boy, I would think you would want to cross-examine on that a lot.
I understand. It's a regrettable oversight. I'm not here to say that this is our best day. This is not the way that we practice law. It was a regrettable mistake. This case
had... And the mistake is that knowledge of the arrest is attributable to the government and they didn't disclose it.
Correct.
But the mistake is also when he testified for the government and he's asked by the government, have you ever been arrested? He lied. He said no, and the prosecutor did not correct him. That's a NAPU violation, right?
So two things. One, the prosecutor couldn't have corrected him as she had no knowledge.
Okay. That's
at that point.
Well, I have. Okay.
She so should
I,
have.
Well, as an officer of the court, knowing this record, you're telling me the lead victim that the FBI had been talking to and the AUSA had been preparing, nobody in the federal government knew that victim had been arrested. Is that your statement to us?
At that time, that is what the record shows, Your Honor. It shows
and as
that they,
as an officer of the court, that's also what you're representing to us.
I'm telling you what's in the record. That is all that was known at the time. I believe.
So just to be clear, the special agent that is working with a lead victim and an assistant U.S. attorney, none of them knew their lead witness had been arrested for months.
I can't speak on behalf of the FBI. There's no evidence in the
Well, anything the FBI knows is attributed to you.
I understand that.
So you have to speak on behalf of the FBI.
So our knowledge, we were unaware. I think everything in the record shows that.
The 302, the Jenks material, none of that reflected an arrest, and the victim never told anybody they'd been arrested.
Correct. And there are no good excuses for this, but the timeline does explain why. This was done prior to the case getting reset 8 times during 2020. And she admittedly said, after the discovery was given in January 2020, he didn't pick it up until September 2020. We do have an ongoing duty, but she never circled back to ask those important questions again.
Because, boy, would a defense attorney to the lead incriminating witness want to say, didn't she just lie on direct when you said you have no exposure to the government? You said you hadn't been arrested, but in fact, you just lied. You have been arrested, and though you're still waiting to find out what happens. And
Correct.
Then a call from a federal prosecutor, and then the case is no-billed?
That part has been explained, Your Honor. I think the judge in this case asked them if there's any evidence of collusion between the state and the federal government. The answer was no.
But there was a call.
To inquire. That is what the call said. Everyone had the right to ask more questions. They went through it at sentencing. And then after that, that is when they withdrew their motion.
Did you notice the district court at sentencing asked the prosecutor almost no questions? The prosecutor never went on record saying that call did not involve. Right? The district court, that
sentence. I believe she did at sentencing. I know there's two hearings. There's the original one in March.
That's
there's
the
subsequent.
The sentencing hearing, prosecutor was very quiet. And I admit, they didn't object to that. They didn't ask for a hearing. They didn't ask for discovery.
Judge could have asked further. I agree. There could have been a better record. We could have fleshed these issues out. But I would like to circle back to what Judge Wilson spoke about earlier, is possibly that was an ambiguous question because of the phrasing in the past. Possibly that did mean before this event. And the evidence shows he was arrested after the fact.
Have you ever been arrested or anything like that? Was there any ambiguity? The witness says no. In the past, no. But the arrest had already happened. That's
yes.
The past. That's a false statement from the lead government victim, and the government doesn't correct it.
And even then, that's on the premise of catching the witness in a lie. It's not, doesn't do anything to the premise of whether the witness was motivated to testify one way or the other.
You're right, and there's no evidence of that. I've given you several cases that show in our briefing that even if the witness thought it would give him a reason, there are a lot of different case line that show some of that doesn't even get past a Brady violation just because a witness happens to believe something. I think we can infer, obviously, the prosecutor couldn't have lent him any support when she didn't know.
What are you saying?
In terms of the witness's belief that the government might help him or something like that.
Oh, I see.
It doesn't logically make sense that if she did not know about it, she was going to be helping him out. When you talk about motivation of him testifying.
You would agree whether or not an arrest is admissible or not for impeachment, it still could be Giglio Brady.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I agree. And I think that really, to be honest, that's the strongest argument. Not that this piece of evidence would have been admissible because the rules and the case law from the circuit doesn't support that. It really is more, what would this disclosure have led to? And I understand that as a practitioner. I think that actually is a more valid argument. And I think the more I've looked at this and grappled with it, I keep coming back to this Lee case that came out several years ago from this circuit that talks about when you're grappling with this issue and it's not just that you didn't tell us this happened. What could we have learned from this piece of evidence? And what this circuit said in that case is, when we're talking about materiality, the big question is this going to undermine the confidence in this verdict?
That is the question.
And when you're looking at that question that's so important for a motion for new trial, the Lee case says you can look at the corroborating evidence.
Okay, and that's where we were asking Postgova. His answer is, as to count two, where he gets virtually the life sentence, this was the testimony.
It was. I think, you know.
So are you arguing against yourself? Are you just being candid and honest with us that this was devastating impeachment as to count
two? I don't think it was devastating in this case. What I'm saying, as a practitioner, I sure do understand how that could have led to something.
Well,
of course.
I appreciate the candor, but that's, so the government's saying, you're just acknowledging this is a very difficult issue then.
Of course, Your Honor, it is. We take this case very seriously. This is not.
But ultimately, is it material here?
And that's what this court is here to determine. And so what makes this case different is the evidence.
Talk about the corroborating evidence.
Sure.
So it says there really wasn't any, as Judge Higginson was alluding.
Yeah. So in addition to the two witnesses, I could spend 20 minutes on that, but the similarity of their testimony, their ages, the police station, the questions that were asked, the acts, all of that together does corroborate each other. But in addition to these two kids that told these stories, we also have the police surveillance video from the station. It corroborates the timing, the kids, where they were, what room things happened in, how long they were in those rooms. Additionally, we have evidence from two separate cell phones. We have the cell phone of the first victim, CL. His screenshots from his cell phone show him reiterating this story to his girlfriend within hours of it happening, telling the exact same story. The second cell phone is from the defendant, Sepulveda, and that shows the time of the offense with the second victim, AA, and that he was pulling up the pornographic websites during the sexual assault to that kid at the exact time they were in the room from the security video and also the kid's testimony. In addition to that, we have the last piece of evidence that was so bizarre was the defendant's story about the chase with the second complainant. So Officer Rivera sees two things. One, the evidence of the kidnapping, which is why that second case is so elevated, when all the other kids are allowed to go home with other parents, but these two kids are forced to stay at the station. So you have that officer corroborating something is not policy. This is not how we do in our department. Secondly, he can corroborate those children went with him. And then you have the corroboration from a custodian of records at the Weslaco PD that says there was no police chase that night. And Officer Rivera also testifies he was told to stay away from the station, to leave that defendant with those boys, to go out and look at some car chase. For 30 to 40 minutes, he was gone, and no car chase occurred. That's a lot of evidence, and all of that corroborates both of these victims. So to say that there possibly was a piece of evidence that might have come back, I think it's highly unlikely. I think if you look at the decisions in Abu Dhabi and Newman and Lee, they all stand for that proposition. When we're looking at the big picture, when we come down to it, is this going to change the verdict and undermine confidence?
The state offense that AA was arrested to, was it What was it? Do you know?
I believe it says sexual assault. I have no other details than what was stated in the record.
So he was alleged to be a sexual assault?
Yes.
And the federal case was not a task force case, state-federal joint, was it?
No.
So no suggestion of the ADA and the ADA?
Not at all. And none of these parties knew each other. The complainants didn't know each other. These cases, nothing about this is connected.
The state incident happened after this incident, right?
Correct, Your Honor. The state incident for that victim happened in January of 2020, and our offense occurred late June of 2019. If you don't have any other questions for me, I can give you back your time.
Thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you.
Garcia? Yeah. Her list of evidence is long, and it was in her brief. You didn't file a reply brief, so it's a little hard for us to do the materiality where you've only got 4 minutes, 50 seconds to say why that isn't a lot of overwhelming evidence. You didn't file a reply brief, right?
No, I did not, but I think I can do it.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, CL, everything she described is as it relates to AA. It has nothing to do with CL's testimony. CL's testimony, she keeps referring to them as boys. CL was 20 years old. AA was the only juvenile. He was the 17-year-old. Everything that she testified about Officer Rivera, about the car chase, that all relates to AA.
Right, but that would come in relevant to state of mind, absence of mistake, right? All that testimony would be able to be used by the jury on as to count two, or am I wrong?
Yeah, it would. It would be allowed to come in, but the question was about corroborating evidence as to what AA said, about what AA testified to. The only person in the room with AA as to what the criminal acts involved here was Mr. Sepulveda. No one else.
Right. So AA gives great graphic detail about the assault of him. It is an equal pattern and practice to someone else that just testified. And you're saying if you'd been able to ask AA, aren't you hoping for favor in a totally different state criminal matter?
In addition to that, the government also said that these people didn't know each other, had nothing to do with each other. This case actually started as a sheriff's office investigation.
The federal case?
The federal case. It's a sheriff's task force officer is the one that first goes to Progreso.
Is that Police in the Department. Record?
It's in the testimony of, hold on.
Okay, so how could they possibly not have known that?
It's in the record. I mean, the sheriff's deputies are the ones that executed the search warrant. It was a state
search
warrant.
The federal case was a joint state.
Was a joint
case.
Correct.
And the state have the victim in custody.
Correct.
The federal government's denying they ever knew that.
Correct. And AA, in addition, AA.
And you were the one at sentencing, and you didn't ask for any discovery, or you didn't ask for an evidentiary hearing.
I did not. AA did not reach out to law enforcement. Law enforcement sought him out. Okay, we don't know what his motivations were. We don't know. I mean, for all intents and purposes, he would have lived his life without ever having complained about it. It wasn't until the sheriff's office reached out to him, where they went through the surveillance and the logs where it had names of who it had been detained, mm-hmm. And then they went and found him.
Okay, so to respond to her arguments about overwhelming guilt,
correct.
Going, you're saying all of it relates to the other count.
It all relates to CL, but not necessarily to not to AA. What happened in the office, where there were no surveillance cameras, where no one else was there, is totally on the shoulders of AA's testimony.
Not really. What about the telephone records?
What about the telephone? I don't understand the question.
The search history that reveals pornographic information on the defendant's phone during the time they're in the office alone.
Correct. And we don't know if AA was the one that asked him to look it up. We don't know if AA has some sort of underlying sexual deviant behavior that he asked the attorney.
Well, but we know that it happened.
We do know that it happened.
It corroborates.
Correct. And because the defendant doesn't have an obligation to produce any evidence, he doesn't have to testify himself. His defense lawyer is not able to elicit that information from him. He can't even question him about it because he doesn't know. The defense lawyer didn't even know.
Was AA questioned about it?
That's what I'm saying. A was not questioned about it. And if the defense lawyer gets this information, let's say in a 302 or in a sheriff's deputy's report, and he sees it, he may ask his client, it's saying he's charged with sexual assault. How did he interact with you? What, I mean, that's just a different area that a defense lawyer is not normally going to go into when defending someone on this type of accusation.
Okay, counsel, thank you very much. The case is submitted. We have four cases.